Chapter 60 Family Quarters, The White House. President Pamela Barnes is sitting in a comfortable chair in her private quarters on the second floor of the White House, having her daily drink of Glenlivet and ice 3 hours ahead of schedule. Her husband Richard is sitting near her, sipping a tumbler of ice water, his long legs and expensive Lucchese Romea cowboy boots stretched out in front of him. He starts to speak, and she holds up her hand. He quickly quiets himself. One of the perks, she thinks, of having your husband work for you. Barnes asks, "We haven't heard from Treasury again, have we?" Richard shakes his head.
"No, Pamela. They're trying various options to locate that account, but it's gone."
She remembers those first few frantic minutes down in the Situation Room after the rescue went south, when she turned to Richard and said, "Pay the ransom. Now. Make it happen. Get those prisoners out of Supermax. Draw up the goddamn pardon. Let's see if we can salvage something from this damn disaster." But there is nothing to be salvaged. The account that was prepared to receive the ransom via a Tor browser on what was called the dark web has been taken down. It seems the window for paying the ransom has been firmly closed by Asim al-Ashid. She takes a strong sip of the bracing drink, feeling it jolt her, wake her, and considers what's before her. Barnes says, "That was quite the roller coaster ride earlier, wasn't it?"
"Yes, Pamela, it was."
"The whole bright afternoon and the following days were ahead of us, weren't they?" she goes on, settling back in the chair. "The daughter of the former president rescued. One of the world's most wanted terrorists captured. Superb footage of our FBI in action, not screwing up for a nice change of pace. Lovely news reports about the Keating family being reunited. Perhaps even a meet later in the Oval Office with me giving awards to the FBI agents who rescued her, complete with the happy Keating family looking on. Smiles and handshakes and hugs all around." Her husband and chief of staff remains quiet. "Good. Our poll numbers reaching the sky," she goes on. "And with all this wonderful news going on, another side benefit is maybe the macho, red, white, and blue wing of the party that still worships that Navy boy would finally shut up and get on the team for our upcoming re-election campaign. But that's not going to happen, Richard, is it?"
"No, Pamela."
She rubs the cold glass tumbler against her forehead, sees the framed photos and plaques and other remembrances from when she was governor of Florida. Up there is an old Florida flag from the late 1800s, showing the state seal against a white background, before that damn red St. Andrew's cross was added back in 1900. Most historians believe it was added to show nostalgia for the old Confederacy. One of Barnes's quiet goals as governor was to strip that disgusting red cross from the flag before she left office. But she knew that most of the voters and their representatives in Tallahassee would never go for it. That's the joy and the scourge of politics. Doing what was right, but also knowing your limitations. Another strong sip. She says, "You're going to let slip a story in the next hour to a trusted reporter, high up in the business, and I mean trusted, Richard. There can't be blowback on this, linking it back to you or to me. Especially me."
"Absolutely,"
he says. She sharpens her voice. "I mean it, Richard." He clasps his still-worn cattle rancher hands in front of him, smiles.
"A trusted foreign policy advisor for one of your predecessors said that most D.C. journalists are 27 years old, no real experience except for reporting on political campaigns, and they literally know nothing. That's still true today, fortunately."
"Good," Barnes says. "The story I want to see appear later on the internet is that the Barnes administration was led on by an intelligence failure from the top levels of FBI and Homeland Security. that the Barnes administration was ready and willing to secretly pay the ransom to free Mel Keating, but was strongly advised not to do so by these advisors. President Barnes was told by agencies she trusted that they had a strong lead on the whereabouts of Mel Keating, and trusting their professional judgment, she let the professionals do their job. That's why the ransom wasn't paid. Richard doesn't say anything. Barnes goes on, feeling strength returning to her with every word she speaks. The story should also say that President Barnes is personally heartbroken over today's failed rescue mission, and that she is ensuring that all federal and local law enforcement officials are redoubling their efforts to find Mel Keating. Got it? He nods.
That's pretty bold.
What's that old saying? Fortune favors the bold? Or the brave? As you pointed out a couple of days ago, Richard, our fortunes are in the tank. We need to climb out no matter what it takes.
There'll be pushback from Director Blair and that moron Paul Charles in Homeland Security. They'll deny everything.
Fine, she says. There were no aides or note takers with us during our last meeting. The FBI can deny all they want, and Paul Charles won't see that he's getting played. He'll leak out to his own pet journalists that he agreed with me to pay the ransom, and he'll say that it's all the FBI's fault. The fool won't see that by defending himself, he'll just be confirming our position. Her husband says,
Impressive. When do you want it?
Now, she says, and Richard gets up from his chair. Before he steps away, she says, Oh, one more thing.
Yes?
Barnes holds out her empty glass tumbler. It's been a bear of a day. Get me another drink. He takes the glass from her hand.
Absolutely, Madam President.
Chapter 61. Saunders Hotel, Arlington, Virginia. Samantha Keating is sitting on a chair in the hotel suite, staring out the window. She can't stand looking at the large screen television, even with the sound off. Seeing video of the failed rescue mission repeated over and over again, and seeing the various talking heads debate, discuss, and argue over whether her girl is still alive. To hell with them all. Matt is talking with FBI Director Blair, and Agent Stahl is in the conversation as well. Next to her, sweet Mattie Perry is staying quiet, holding a Gideon's Bible in her hands, silently reading and praying for Mel. Samantha closes her eyes, seeing again the overhead view of that damn house and the pond nearby, and she's not sure why, but there's a nagging feeling of deja vu, as if she's seen that house, as if she's been to that house, and she knows it can't be true. It's impossible, but still the feeling remains. She's a doctor and a professor. She believes only in evidence, and especially when it comes to archaeology, solid evidence. No research or digs stemming from legends of druids or Irish monks landing in North America. Only facts. That is what propelled her in her Basque research. The facts of their voyages to North America were true and were signposts for her eventual research and digs and that lovely discovery of a previously unknown Basque settlement in the Americas. She wishes she could remember the sheer innocent joy of discovery that happened days back in that coastal town of Hitchcock before those two Maine state police detectives raced up to tell her that her life was broken. More talk over there in the corner with her husband and the FBI and Secret Service, thrashing out options where to go next and how to go next. One big question is how the world's most wanted terrorist and his cousin were able to slip Mel out of that house through such a tight law enforcement cordon. For Samantha and everyone else are certain that Mel was there. The gold ring, carefully hidden, proves it. Mattie continues her silent reading. The three over there continue their chattering. And that memory returns of being at that house, over the water, and it comes to her. Nearly 2 years ago, Samantha was contacted by a friend of hers from the University of Maine in Orono, who said an elderly uncle claimed to have some Basque pottery he had recovered while working on a fishing trawler. The uncle was convinced by his niece to turn over the pottery to Samantha, but the problem was that he had left his life as a fisherman and gone full prepper, moving to an isolated lake in the Great North Woods in Upper Maine. Getting there meant driving for hours over dirt roads, or... Matt, Samantha says, getting up and going over to him and Agent Stahl and FBI Director Blair. Yes? That small pond, the one adjacent to the house where Mel was kept? How big is it? What? Matt asks, confused. How big is it? The longest stretch. Director Blair says, I don't see why. Matt says, David, you know how to work Google better than me. Find out. On it, Mr. President. Agent Stahl goes to the keyboard, and Blair still looks confused. But Samantha sees a look on Matt's face that shows he understands what she's looking for. Got it, Mr. President, Agent Stahl says. Long Pea Pond. Its greatest length is just over 3,000 feet. Samantha says, float plane. That's how they got out, without being noticed. A float plane came in and took the three of them away. Director Blair says, how do you know? Tears are coming to her eyes as she remembers that sunny day, a peaceful and pleasant day. No real worries. Remembers flying over forested lands and peaks, glimpsing ponds and lakes below, eagerly looking forward to seeing what that old fisherman found, which turned out to be a Sears and Roebuck soup bowl circa 1930. Samantha says, a Cessna T-206 float plane with a load of 4 passengers can take off and land from a body of water that's 2,932 feet in length. I know that because I flew on one 2 years back. That's how they did it, flying low to the ground, getting in and out, and then... Her husband says, if he or she is a good pilot, flying low to the ground to avoid radar, it could work. Director Blair steps away, gets on her phone, starts speaking quickly and firmly to whoever's on the other end. Agent Stahl does the same. Matt looks at her, obviously tired and anguished, but nevertheless conveying his loving respect. Any other time or place or situation, Samantha would relish the look. Good job, he says. Samantha says, I know how they got her out. I don't know where she is now, Matt. Not good enough. Not by a long shot.
Chapter 62. Saunders Hotel, Arlington, Virginia. Following Sam's insight, some busy minutes are spent on the phone, and then Director Blair says, Mr. President, Mrs. Keating, I'm sorry to do this, but I give her a weary nod. You've got to go back to your office, I understand, and probably take a nasty phone call from the president's chief of staff. She gestures to the chubby male FBI agent from before. Special Agent Burke will stay here, will be my personal liaison to you and your wife. I'll keep you apprised of any developments. And getting nasty phone calls from Richard Barnes is all part of the joy of the job. Thanks, Lisa. Blair goes to Samantha, pauses, gives her a hug, and then gives me one as well. Totally unprofessional and unnecessary, but I find it comforting. She says, we'll get her back safe, honest. I know you will, I say. But Samantha stares at the carpeted floor and says nothing as Director Blair and three of her agents depart. Madeline Perry, my chief of staff, says, I'll get back to work in the other room, sir. I'll send up some food for you all. What would you like? Anything, I say. Nothing. At some point, there's a thick silence in the room that matches the smell of sweat, despair, and uneaten sandwiches and cheeseburgers. Sam is on her side of the bed, dozing, and FBI Special Agent Burke is sitting back in his chair, arms crossed against his plump chest. Agent Stahl is in his own chair, on the other side of the room, and he's sleeping. About the only development came hours ago, when three witnesses in the area of Long Pea Pond said that they saw a light gray float plane flying nearby earlier this morning, flying low, hugging the tree lines and peaks. One witness is certain that the aircraft flew north. Another is equally certain that it went west. And the third has no concept of direction and could only vaguely say, it was up there somewhere, I'm sure of it. I go over and open the door to the adjoining suite. It's quiet in there, with staffers and others dozing in chairs or on the floor, but Madeline Perry is staring intently at her computer screen. "Maddie?" I say. She seems startled and glances over at me. "Oh, sorry, sir. You surprised me. What is it?" I say, "It's quiet now. I need to do something, something I should have done hours ago." "What's that?" "Talk to Tim Kenyon's parents," I say. "Can you arrange it?" "Certainly, sir." Less than 15 minutes later, Madeline Perry comes into the second suite and hands over her phone. "Bill Kenyon, sir," she says, "and his wife, Laura." I take the phone, take a breath. When I was president, I made similar calls to the fathers and mothers, husbands and wives of personnel who had been killed in the line of duty. None of the calls were easy, but there was a protocol to follow. The commander-in-chief expressing the nation's sympathy to the family of those who had made the ultimate sacrifice. But now? Now I was expressing my own personal sympathy to a father and mother who lost their son because he was dating my daughter. "Mr. Kenyon? Mrs. Kenyon? This is Matt Keating." A tired male voice. "Hello, Mr. President." And a fainter woman's voice saying just, "Hello." "May I call you Bill and Laura?" "I guess," he says, and his wife doesn't say anything. I close my eyes. We're all grieving in our own ways, but their grief is real and solid. Mine is the grief of an unknown outcome for my kidnapped daughter, each second filled with terrible thoughts of what might be happening to her. I say, "Bill, Laura, I'm so sorry for what happened to Tim. I met him a few times during the last couple of months, and he was a great young man, very smart, very personable. I know Mel very much enjoyed being with him." I run out of things to say. "What else?" "Sorry your beloved son had the misfortune to date the daughter of the president who made so many enemies and died because he was collateral damage." I finally say, "The FBI, Homeland Security, and hundreds of police officers and other investigators are tracking down Tim's killer. I know that must be small comfort, but his killer won't escape. I promise you that." A long silence ensues, and I wonder if we've been disconnected. Then I hear the sad sigh of Tim's father. He says, "Those are good words, Mr. President, and I appreciate it, but right now it's all words, isn't it? I mean, you look at the news, you read the papers, and what do you see? A lot of stories about your girl, nearly nothing about my boy. And what little there is about my boy is just so much crap, misspelling his name or getting his age wrong." I hear a few sobs and then a click, and I imagine it's Tim's mother hanging up. But his father continues, "Your girl has it all. Comfortable life, best school she ever wanted. She could choose any life she desired. My Tim," his voice struggles, "had to chase down scholarships, grants, work after school and during the summer to make enough to get to a school like Dartmouth. He had hopes, Mr. President, and Laura and I, we had hopes for him too. Now he's gone because he reached too far. Wanted to date your girl, and that got him killed." I wait, not wanting to interrupt this grieving man. And he says, choking back the tears, "My wife and I, we're going to pray tonight again for our boy. And then we're going to pray for you and your wife. Pray that you don't have to go through what we're experiencing right now, Mr. President." He disconnects the call. I put Maddie's phone down and stretch my back and look up at the white plaster ceiling, hoping that if God is in an answering mood tonight, he will answer the Kenyon's prayers. Mel, where are you? When I was a kid growing up in rural Texas, hours to the west of Austin, I was fascinated by the Navy, even though there were no rivers or lakes of note near our small dusty town. But we were close to Fredericksburg, where famed World War II Fleet Admiral Chester Nimitz was born, and I must have gone to the museum marking his life a half a dozen times. Among the scores of books I read about the Navy in those years was one called The Terrible Hours, about the desperate attempts to rescue sailors trapped on the USS Squalus, a submarine that in 1939 sank off the coast of New Hampshire during a training accident. A great book, a great title, and I mean no disrespect to those long-dead 33 rescued men, but I would gladly exchange their terrible hours for my own terrible hours during the glacial passage of time following the failed rescue of Mel. The hours slowly pass, with meals half eaten, phone calls, visits from representatives from Homeland Security and the Secret Service, even some cryptic briefings from CIA officers. I have some comforting words with Samantha, each of us trying to buck the other up as the red numerals on the various clocks flip their way into the next day. Maddie Perry is busy next door as well, juggling lots of phone calls and visits, an amazing number of them from psychics who claim to know where Mel is at this moment. Sometimes the readings are precise, with a street name and number, and other times it's a psychic thinking that Mel is near a railroad by a body of water. One phone call that isn't received, however, is from Pamela Barnes, President of the United States. At some point in the middle of the night, my body gives up and I fall into a troubled sleep on the unmade bed, Samantha cuddled up next to me. A touch on the shoulder and I'm instantly awake. A chubby man is looking at me, and for a moment I don't recognize him in the low light of the suite's bedroom. "Sir," he says. Now I know who he is, FBI Special Agent Burke, who's still dressed in his gray suit, though his white shirt is wrinkled and stained and his navy blue necktie's undone. I swing off the bed, trying not to wake up Samantha, but she's sleeping as lightly as I am, and she says, "What is it? What's going on?" Burke says, "Sir, ma'am, Director Blair is coming here. She should arrive in about 10 minutes. Samantha says, What time is it?" I look at the bedside clock. "It's 2 a.m. Agent Burke, why is she coming here?" Burke looks tired, troubled. "Sir, we've received word that Asim al-Rashid is going to be releasing a statement within the hour."
Chapter 63. Family Quarters. The White House. Among the several things that President Pamela Barnes hates about her job is knowing that her time is never really her own, that other people have demands upon her, and that at any minute or hour of the day or night, she will have to respond to some emerging crisis or disaster. For years, her predecessors ran TV advertisements during election season that claimed that they would have what it takes to answer the phone at 3 a.m. in case of an emergency. But the honest truth is that she's never been awakened by a phone call during the night. Like now. It's just a gentle knock on the bedroom door, with a subsequent louder knock. She switches on a bedside lamp and says, "Come in. I'm awake." After her inauguration, Barnes made it clear to her husband Richard that her staff should never delay in waking her up in case something of national importance was occurring. She was remembering an observation from a famed New York Times columnist who quoted a White House aide as saying, "You can't be fired for waking the president. You can only be fired for not waking him. Or her." A familiar figure slides into the room from the corridor, where a Secret Service agent has apparently accompanied Felicia Taft, Deputy Chief of Staff. "Sorry to disturb you, ma'am," Taft says. Barnes's Chief of Staff is deep asleep next to her, a pillow over his head. She's often gently teased Richard that he could sleep through an earthquake, to which he has jokingly replied, "Never been an earthquake in Florida as long as I've been around, so we'll never know, will we?" She gets out of bed, puts on her old blue terry cloth robe, which has traveled many miles and years with her. "Is it news about Mel Keating?" she asks. "Yes, ma'am." "What is it?" Taft says, "Ma'am, the watch officers in the Situation Room have received word that Al Jazeera will be releasing a statement from Asim al-Rashid within the hour. The Deputy National Security Advisor is on her way there now." Barnes slides her feet into soft leather sandals and says, "I'll be there shortly as well." Taft goes out, softly closing the door behind her, and Barnes leans over the bed, shakes her husband and chief of staff awake. He coughs, grunts, and sits up, bare-chested, wearing only a pair of blue pajama bottoms.
"What's up, Pamela?"
"Get up. Get dressed," she says. "Time to earn your salary. Asim al-Rashid is going to announce something in the next hour. We need to get down to the Situation Room." Richard yawns, scratches at the back of his head.
"Do we know what he's going to say?"
Something horrible and bloody, she says. He moves to get out of bed.
For sure?
Barnes says, an educated guess. What, you think he's going to give up Mel Keating because he likes her and is going to forgive all? Come along, Richard. No time to waste.
Chapter 64. Saunders Hotel, Arlington, Virginia. The suite is crowded again, with FBI Director Lisa Blair and three more FBI agents, and they've set up another television screen which has a direct feed coming in from Al Jazeera in Doha, Qatar. The suite's own set is tuned to CNN. Even at this ungodly hour, Lisa is wearing a DC power suit, dark slacks and jacket, white blouse, and her hair is perfectly styled. Samantha is on the edge of the bed, staring, hands clasped tightly in her lap, and I catch her attention, and the look in her eyes is haunted, both seeing me and staring 1,000 yards away. I've seen that look before, on fellow team members, or Army soldiers or Marines in the field, who've been out too long and have seen way too much. When that look comes to someone's eyes, he or she is perilously close to collapse. I hug her, but it's like hugging a store mannequin. I step back and Lisa checks the time and says, our FBI liaison in Doha tells us that it's a video message dropped off by a courier, flash drive or thumb drive. We're trying to track down the courier, but her voice trails off. Sure, I know what she's about to say. Any American law enforcement agency in a foreign country works under tremendous limitations. Trailed by the host country's intelligence agencies, not able to proceed with an investigation without the cooperation of the locals, and not able to work quickly or respond to developments, like fighting with ropes of taffy covering one's arms and legs. The feed coming into the two television screens is the same, though the CNN feed is just a few seconds behind the one coming from Al Jazeera. I sit down next to Samantha, hug her waist, and she slightly leans into me as we both wait. The male Al Jazeera anchor is well-dressed, with black hair and a mustache. He's speaking fast, face lit up with excitement of reporting a breaking story. Can we have a sound, please? I ask. From Al Jazeera? One of the male FBI agents obliges and steps back. Others in the room include Secret Service Agent David Stahl and my Chief of Staff, Maddie Perry, who's clasping a Bible to her chest and looks like she hasn't slept in 2 days. The chaos and the fear I'm feeling is intermingled with affection for this smart and strong-willed woman. She could have gone anywhere in the Barnes administration or private industry, but decided to follow me from the White House into exile. In a crisp voice, the television announcer says, we will now air the video supplied to us by Asim al-Rashid. We have not reviewed this video because of its timeliness and newsworthiness. You and our valued viewers will be seeing this for the very first time. The screen cuts away from the anchor's desk, and there's a blue screen, bursts of lines of static, and the picture becomes clear. A rough rock face, some moss and tiny plants at its base, which leads out to a rock ledge. Asim al-Rashid walks into the frame, seen from his waist up. He's wearing a black t-shirt and a smile on his face. He looks sharper, harder, deadlier without his beard. He nods.
Assalamu alaikum, Matthew Keating, Samantha Keating, President Pamela Barnes, and all who are viewing this. I apologize that this is not a, what you call a live feed, but a recording from several hours ago, after we departed the home of Mr. Maccomber in your White Mountains. And here we are, in these mountains still. My thanks to Mr. Maccomber for his unwitting hospitality, and my apologies for what happened to his home. I am sure the proper authorities will compensate him for the damages caused by your FBI.
The suite is quiet. Sam is firm against my side, my arm still around her waist. Asim says,
and why have we come to this, Matthew Keating? A simple answer. For it is all due to your actions 2 years past, when you killed my wife, Layla al-Ashid, and my sweet daughters, Amina, Zara, and Fatima. I am a jihadist, a warrior of Allah, and I knew it was my fate to die on the battlefield. But my wife? My daughters? They were innocents, and you killed them. Their blood is on your hands. Their blood will be on your hands until you die.
A long pause. It's like he's staring right at me.
Here we are, according to the great lawgiver Hammurabi and the laws of the holy prophet Moses and the laws of Islam, I am due compensation. I am due reparation. I am due justice. I asked for all this and I was ignored. I was mocked. And yesterday morning, armed men attempted to kill me.
He looks to his side for a second, like something is interrupting him, and he says,
"And is what I asked for so unreasonable? I asked for a sum much less than what you pay for one of your F-22 Raptor aircraft. Is your daughter's life not worth the cost of one of your aircraft that bombs and strafes innocents?"
He smiles wider. The bastard knows he's making a point that will be accepted by many people here and around the world.
"I asked for the release of three of my comrades in arms,"
he says.
"I know the excuse for not letting them go. This government does not negotiate with terrorists. Oh, please. The United States government negotiates with terrorists whenever it suits their needs, their desires. The United States counts as allies governments who do the same as I do, only on a much larger scale. Ask yourself then, Matthew Keating, why is it that your government does not desire your daughter's release?"
Samantha is trembling against me like we're in the middle of a blizzard with the heat off in our room.
"Finally,"
he says,
"I asked for a slip of paper, a promise from President Pamela Barnes to ensure my safety. A reasonable request, I'm sure you understand, and a fair exchange for your daughter's safety. But what was her answer? Armed men trying to kill me and my cousin Faraj."
Asim shakes his head.
"According to laws and tradition that I learned while growing up, all I sought was simple justice, and that was not offered to me. Alas, Matthew Keating, this is what I am forced to offer in return."
The next few seconds brutally bring me back to my first nighttime parachute jump while I was in SEAL training. My first half dozen jumps took place in the daylight, when I could see the landscape below me, the other parachutists, the distant horizon, and overhead blue sky and clouds. But on that windy night, departing from a four-engine C-130 Hercules, I was stepping out into the darkness, into the unknown, hoping and trusting in my training and my equipment. Now, there is no trust in anything, just blindly again stepping out into the unforgiving darkness. For the camera slowly pulls back, revealing Asim al-Rashid, and on her knees beside him is our daughter, Mel Keating, eyes wide with fright behind her eyeglasses, arms bound tightly behind her.
Chapter 65. East 33rd Street, New York, New York. In his home office in the Great Bay Condominiums, Jiang Lijun of the Chinese Ministry of State Security is smoking a Zhonghua cigarette and watching the scene videotaped from somewhere in the American White Mountains unfold before him on a small, wall-mounted television set. The office is modest and has no windows, for Jiang doesn't want the surveillance cameras and snoopers out there keeping track of his activities. A light switching on at this hour of the morning would send a note of concern among the CIA that something is up with the Chinese. Which is true. A few minutes ago, his wristwatch vibrated, waking him, and in the darkness he got out of bed without waking his wife, Zhen, or their daughter, Li Na. In his office, he picked up the secure phone that connected him to the mission, which is only two blocks away, and the night duty officer said, "You're advised to turn on one of the American cable channels, Comrade Jiang." He takes another puff from his cigarette. His office has shelves of books, mostly historical and political works about the United States and China, and there is no computer terminal here to be hacked or filing cabinets to be pried open. Half of the floors in this building are owned by the mission to house its diplomats and staff, and Jiang uses this room for thinking, reading, and contemplation. On the television set is a crisp video of Asim al-Rashid speaking clearly and confidently into the camera. "I ask for a sum much less than what you pay for one of your F-22 Raptor aircraft. Is your daughter's life not worth the cost of one of your aircraft that bombs and strafes innocents?" Not a bad question, Jiang thinks, sitting comfortably in blue cotton pajamas topped with a red silk robe that once belonged to father. The man on the television is speaking plainly and truthfully, and Jiang has to admire how he holds himself. His words are powerful, and at any time and place, Asim al-Rashid could have become a prominent political leader in his world, or, as Jiang knows, a medical doctor, the man's original dream and desire. But he chose the bloody path of a terrorist, and even though there are millions of Bantan, stupid eggs, here and abroad who are now thinking kindly of him, Jiang remembers another Asim al-Rashid. 4 years ago, in a dusty, windswept collection of huts and dirt roads laughingly called a village in southern Libya, Jiang was tasked with overseeing the construction of a vital oil pipeline in this district. But the equipment supplied by the China State Construction Engineering Corporation had been sabotaged, and oil workers hired from Georgia had been threatened and chased away. The tribe that lived in this village and others in the area refused to cooperate with the pipeline's construction, even with the promise of money and laborer jobs for their men. The pipeline was a month overdue, and Jiang was told to fix it. No detailed orders, no suggestions, no recommendations. Just fix it. Jiang stood next to a battered yellow Toyota pickup truck with two personal guards from a Pakistan contract force that had accompanied him from Tripoli. And they watched as Asim al-Rashid convinced the tribe to stop its actions against the pipeline project. A half dozen other pickup trucks were parked in a semicircle. Gunshots. Shouts. A scream. Al-Rashid and his collection of fighters herded 8 men and women into the dirt area in front of the parked trucks. They were forced to kneel. A crowd of about 50 villagers was clustered together, held in place by Asim's armed men. A number of young boys and girls were brought forward, and then Asim went down the line of kneeling men and women and shot each one of them in the back of the head. The women villagers screamed and lamented in an Arabic sing-song that chilled Jiang. And when a satisfied Asim al-Rashid came up to Jiang, he said, "You will have no more problems in this village." Jiang asked, "Why did you force the children to watch you?" Asim looked surprised to be asked such a question. "Because they will remember forever what happened here, and will tell their children and their children's children of what happens when you oppose Asim al-Rashid and your great and powerful China." On his desk are day-old copies of Reference News, People's Daily, and the Global Times, flown in each day from Beijing. It's always good to keep abreast of what's going on back home, not rely on stories filed on the internet, which could be re-edited or disappeared in seconds. Jiang's phone is next to the newspapers, and a screen lights up, meaning an incoming call. He picks up the receiver. "Yes?" His boss, Li Baodong, breathes heavily into the phone and says, "Your boy is speaking well on the television, isn't he?" Jiang bristles at the tone of Li's voice, thinks, "One day, you fat man, you'll get what you deserve, and I'll be in your chair. But when the time comes, I'll make sure to order a new one, for I don't want to sit where your fat, sweaty ass has been over the years." Jiang says, "He does have his talents." "And stupidity and stubbornness as well," Li says. "A pity you could not convince him to release the president's daughter." "Ah, look, there she is now." "Not a pity," Jiang thinks. "Not a pity at all." Li says, "What will the Hundan do next?" With satisfaction, Jiang sees motion on the television screen. "I think we're about to find out, Comrade Li," he says, leaning back in his chair.
Chapter 66. White House Situation Room. President Pamela Barnes yawns and desperately wants a cup of coffee, but knows better, realizing that a shot of caffeine right now will result in her never getting back to sleep. She has on gray sweatpants and an orange long-sleeved Florida Gators t-shirt, and Richard is next to her, with Deputy National Security Advisor Sarah Palumbo on her other side. Up on the main screen is an anchor for Al Jazeera in Qatar, and Barnes glumly thinks that most of her predecessors went months without being shepherded into the Situation Room, And here she is now, in this basement area, 2 days in a row. Richard says,
"Aw, shit. There's the bastard."
Pamela looks at the smug and arrogant face of Asim al-Ashid, who is standing in front of a blank stone formation somewhere in the White Mountains. Asim speaks fluently and forcefully in good English about justice and money and the cost of an F-22. Barnes says, "Sarah, is there anything we can get from this about where he is? How this footage got to Al Jazeera?" Her deputy national security advisor says, "I'm afraid not much, ma'am. Unfortunately, he's good at his tradecraft. If this message was recorded some hours ago, then he has moved on to somewhere else. I would guess that he recorded this message onto a thumb drive or flash drive, gave it to some trusted courier who in turn emailed it to another courier in Qatar, who hand-delivered it to Al Jazeera's studios." Richard mutters,
"Goddamn studio should have been taken out by accident years ago. Damn terrorist supporters. Royal pain in the ass they are."
Barnes says to Sarah, "What's the read on Asim al-Ashid? He seems so controlled." On the screen, Asim is now talking about her own actions, and she wishes that the useless military out there had his GPS coordinates down cold. Because even though she's always been opposed to extrajudicial drone killing, she would be so tempted to drop a Hellfire missile into that man's face. "Ma'am," Deputy National Security Advisor Palumbo says, "the latest analysis we've received from psychologists on contract with the CIA is that Asim al-Ashid is a classic narcissistic sociopath who had a troubled and poverty-stricken childhood and who is now constantly seeking attention and reaffirmation of his importance." Barnes asks, "Meaning?" Palumbo says, "He loves the attention, loves the spotlight. He doesn't want it to end. They predicted that if he were to make another appearance following the ransom deadline's expiration, he would add additional conditions, additional requests to show off his importance and special nature. Keep his face and name in the news." Barnes says, "But the man's a killer. Children, women, families, he's murdered them all, up close and personal." The Deputy National Security Advisor says, "That's part of his sociopathic tendencies. The more shocking the crimes, the more attention he receives. Like now, he's in his element. The entire world focusing on what he's saying and what his next set of demands will be. That's all he'll do today." The camera pulls back, and with a jolt that makes Barnes instantly awake, the daughter of Matthew and Samantha Keating becomes visible. She's kneeling on a rocky surface, arms bound behind her, and she's wearing khaki shorts and a dirty and torn light gray Dartmouth sweatshirt. Mel Keating stares up, head trembling, eyes wide behind her glasses, her hair a tangled mess. Barnes remembers the last time she saw Mel Keating, on Barnes's inauguration day, when she looked like a typical teenage girl, a bit overwhelmed by what was going on around her, with all the pomp and ceremony. Asim al-Ashid says something in Arabic. Barnes gasps, sees what he's holding in his hands, and in a trembling voice over the next few horrible seconds, her husband Richard says,
"With all due respect, Ms. Palumbo, those hired CIA experts are full of shit."
Chapter 67. Saunders Hotel, Arlington, Virginia. On the screen is our daughter Mel, staring up through her eyeglasses, eyes wide, and I see with a pang of memory that she's still wearing that Dartmouth sweatshirt she had on the last time I saw her, on that bright, beautiful day, when she was about to leave on a hike with her boyfriend and offered to bring me back pastries from our local general store. Oh, Mel. Asim al-Ashid steps out of the camera's view for a moment, returns, and displays what's in his strong hands, a sharp-looking saber. In the suite, there are gasps and cries, and I stare and think, that blessed late night 19 years ago in a room at Naval Medical Center San Diego with a worn but smiling Samantha in bed, holding a pink little baby against her and saying, "Oh, Matt, she's so perfect. She's so perfect." Hasim al-Rashid's face hardens, and he barks out a phrase in Arabic. Little Mel at 5 years old, face serious and with eyeglasses fastened with a band across the back of her head, chubby legs scraped and cut, pink t-shirt and white shorts, picking up the little two-wheeled bicycle and saying, "Daddy, I can do it this time. I know I can." The sword rises up, up, and up, light glistening off the blade. Mel kneeling still, eyes closed tight, lips pressed together. At my side, Samantha's moaning, the low, heart-rending sound of a mother in despair. Mel winning her first district track meet at 12, jumping over the finish line, looking behind to see her nearest competitor meters away, turning and smiling, raising her skinny arms up, just so damn happy. Samantha and me clapping hard and with joy from the sidelines. The sword held high up. The entire world seems to stop. I'm on the edge of that aircraft at night, ready to step out into the darkness. In her bedroom on the second floor of the White House, Mel curled up in bed, covers almost over her head, her face red and eyes swollen from all the crying and her saying, "Dad, why do they hate me? They were laughing at me on television, and millions of people were laughing too. Dad, what did I do wrong?" And me gently stroking her back under the covers, knowing I have no good answer. The sword is moving fast, coming down toward my girl. The TV screen on the left cuts away from what a producer in Atlanta knows is about to happen. The screen now shows the CNN feed with one of the shocked overnight anchors. Al Jazeera keeps on broadcasting, though it looks like the anchor is shouting at someone off-screen, telling them to pull the plug as well. I'm stepping out into the darkness. Just 3 days ago. Only 3 days. Mel happy and smiling. Hair wet from just being in the shower, looking so damn happy, so alive. So ready for the day, and asking me if I wanted her to do something for me, and then laughing before walking away, me asking her to call me when she got cell service the next day. And a reply, "Sure, Dad. You can trust me. I'll be safe and sound." The flash of the descending sword. Everything at a halt here in this room, and at the very last second, Mel opens her eyes and yells in a strong, firm voice, "Mommy, don't look!" I grab Samantha's head, pull her into my shoulder as the sword strikes. A burst of blood spatters against the camera lens. A low, mournful, "Oh!" comes from someone in the room. I hold Samantha tight, tight, tight. I want to look away, but I won't allow myself to do that. A finger seems to smudge away some of the blood on the camera lens, smearing it but keeping the lens clear enough to show what's on the rocky surface. A figure curled on its side, the word "Dartmouth" still visible on the dirty, torn sweatshirt. Khaki shorts, strong, bare legs, dirty foot soles. Some feet away, I can't say what I see. Just an oval shape with frizzy blonde hair, the shock of blood, and a pair of eyeglasses, alone on the rock. I step out into the darkness and fall forever.
Part 3.
Chapter 68. 2 weeks later, Lake Marie, New Hampshire. I'm sitting in a wicker chair on the enclosed porch of my home, staring out at the waves of rain pelting the lake and the nearby forested hills. There are two Boston whalers out there on the lake, Secret Service agents in each, doubling the usual water watch. Out in the woods surrounding my home, members of the Secret Service cat team are on aggressive patrol, and the New Hampshire State Police have set up roadblocks redirecting traffic away from the entrance to my access road. If there's been a better example of closing the barn door after the proverbial horse has escaped, I've not heard of it. The rain continues to fall. No matter the weather, it's been cold and raining here for 2 weeks straight. Besides the Secret Service agents in and around the compound, also doubled in number, I'm alone in the house. Samantha went back to Maine last week and has again thrown herself into her archaeological dig. Our few phone calls have been polite and strained. Before she left, there were lots of tears, hugs, rages, recriminations, slamming doors, and more tears and hugs. And long talks into the night, sharing memories of Mel. My chief of staff, Madeline Perry, has visited twice, both times bringing along a selection of sympathy cards and letters from all over the world, including one that was slipped in by mistake, with a scrawled note saying, "Good that your ugly girl is gone, your bitch wife and you should be next, traitor." Last week, Yvette Cloutier, a local French-Canadian woman who's been working as a house cleaner here for 6 months, burst into tears when she saw me in the living room. She held my hands in hers and prayed aloud in French, and only stopped when one of the new Secret Service agents gently led her away. I feel like I'm trapped in a large funeral home, with no body to grieve over but lots of quiet mourners moving about, not daring to speak too loudly or laugh in my presence. I've been trying to avoid the news coverage as much as possible, but what I've seen is both heartening and discouraging. There have been prayer vigils in Mel's memory at religious institutions across the nation, police and military raids on terrorist cells allied with Asim al-Rashid here and in Canada, Britain, and France, and hundreds of people have clustered on the roads leading to my home bearing flowers and cards. But there are those taking advantage of Mel's death to make their own points, from politicians blaming the Barnes administration for allowing this to happen, to others criticizing New Hampshire's governor for not immediately deputizing every gun owner in the state to assist in the earlier search. There are also rumors that my successor is planning military action. But where? And how? And who knows where Asim al-Rashid is now? Having slipped back into the shadows, as he's done so many times before, is he in Canada, the States, or hiding among his supporters around the world? About the only other distraction here was when, soon after Samantha went back to work, three FBI agents arrived from D.C., intent on going into Mel's empty room to look through her belongings and pack up her laptop for forensic analysis. I stood in front of her bedroom door. "Not going to happen," I said, unable to stand the thought of strangers going through Mel's possessions or papers and reading her private thoughts and searches on her PC. "Sir," the lead FBI agent said, "we need to see if there's any evidence your daughter had been in earlier contact with." I said, "Not going to happen. Nobody's going into Mel's room. Nobody's looking at her computer. Sir, the only way any of you are getting into my daughter's room is through me, and the Secret Service might have something to say about that." The FBI left. And that night, I slept on the floor in Mel's room, curled up in a blanket, just mourning, remembering, and mourning some more. I rub at my face in the stubble. It's been a few days since I've shaved. The first few days back at Lake Marie were filled with lots of drinking and guilt. Then I shook that off and got to work, going for long runs along the access road and nearby trails. Never alone, of course. And working out in a small shed near the garage that has some weights and other training gear. And I did other training, the type of training I've hidden away from my protective detail. I check the time, 5 p.m. I take out my iPhone and hold it up and start recording a short video message for my wife. "Hey, Sam, it's me," I say. "Here's the weather at Lake Marie." I slowly rotate the phone so she can get a view of the dock, moored pontoon boat, and sodden beach. I bring the phone back and say, "Lots of rain. At least it's keeping the tourists and gawkers away. I hope the weather's better up in Maine. Hope you're making progress. Hope you're making history up there." I stop, thinking, idiot. Yeah, she's making history, all right. The sorrowful first lady away from her husband. The only first lady to have her daughter murdered. Anyway, if it's sunny out tomorrow, I'll take out the tools and get back to clearing brush. Nothing much else is going on. Meaning, yes, Sam. Our daughter's body hasn't been found yet. That's the news from Lake Marie. Love you. Miss you. Call if you get a chance. Bye for now. I switch off and email the message to Sam, wondering if she will call me back. I look out once more at the rain, at the drawn-up canoes, and the memory of the canoe race and of seeing Mel for the last time comes charging back, and I wipe at my eyes. The screen door opens, and Agent David Stahl comes out, nods, and then looks out to the cold, dark gray waters of the lake. He's lost weight. His face is drawn and tired, and it seems like years ago when he and I were out there on those sunny waters. I say, take a load off, David. Thank you, sir. He drags over a wicker chair and sits down. He has on boat shoes, tan slacks, and a wrinkled dark blue polo shirt. A few seconds pass, and he says, sir, you know we have some new agents here. I think tonight might be a good time to introduce them to your poker skills. Any other time, I'd smile and eagerly say yes, for one of the simple joys I've had is playing poker, sometimes night-long sessions with the agents stationed here, winning more often than losing. But this isn't any other time. Maybe not tonight, I say, and maybe not ever if Agent Peyton is on shift. David grimaces. One of the new agents assigned here is Agent Brett Peyton, who is brash and full of himself and who I guess is reporting directly to Faith Murray, the deputy assistant director in charge of the Presidential Protection Detail. She's preparing a purge and disciplinary action against my original detail. What's the latest, I ask? The search is expanding into Maine and New York State, as well as southern Vermont and southern Ontario and Quebec. There's been a lot of reports and tips about that float plane, but unfortunately nobody can recall a registration number, so we can't trace that. And with the number of isolated lakes, rivers, and ponds within the flying range of that float plane, he stops. We both know he doesn't have to continue. The odds against Mel's body being found anytime soon are very high indeed. I cross my arms, look at the canoes, wondering if I'll ever race David out there on the lake. I try very hard to speak the next several sentences in a firm and unwavering voice, like I'm giving a State of the Union address, and with the first words, I fail. When she's found, no matter where, David, and it's time for her to be moved, I want you there, and five other agents from the original detail. I want you to take her home, all right? Tears are rolling down his face, and he says hoarsely, Mr. President, we can't do that. Why? Because we failed her, and you and Mrs. Keating. It wouldn't be right. I shake my head. We all failed her. David, do it. All right? You take my girl home. He just nods. I nod in return. After a few more gray minutes pass, I say, I admire you, David, you and the other agents, for the job that you do. For keeping alert during long hours of boredom, traveling with me while hearing the same dull speech over and over again, and putting up with us protectees. It's a hard job that most people know nothing about, only the bullshit they see on TV or at the movies. He doesn't say anything, which is fine. My apologies in advance, David, because in this hard time, I'm going to make your life and the lives of the other agents very, very difficult indeed. How's that, sir? I look again at the sodden beach. Think of the volleyball net being up, Mel and her Dartmouth friends laughing and playing, enjoying the best times of their lives. Every day here, a perfect day with lots of sun and no rain, no clouds. Ever. I say, I'm going dark over the next few weeks. I'll be going places talking to people, some not so nice people probably. And there will come a day when I find Asim al-Rashid. And I'm going to look at him face to face so he knows I'm there, standing in front of him during those last few seconds. I pause. Then I'm going to blow his goddamn head off. Chapter 69. Lake Marie, New Hampshire. To Agent Stahl's credit, he doesn't blink, he doesn't protest, he doesn't say a word. I say, along the way, I might find the float plane pilot who helped Asim escape with my girl. I might find the man who sold him the rope that tied her up and the man who gave Asim the sword he used to behead her. And if I come across these people, I'll kill every one of them. I pause again. No word from Agent Stahl. I say, at some point, I'm going to leave here without your approval and without the knowledge of the director of the Secret Service and the Secretary of Homeland Security. Do you understand what I'm saying, David? Yes, sir. There's nothing on this earth that's going to stop me, I say, my voice even and not quavering, not like before when I was talking about recovering Mel's body. If you want to make your arguments to convince me to do otherwise, go right ahead. It'll be a waste of your breath, but I'll be polite and listen. If you and the rest of the agents here want to stop me from doing this, you're going to have to shackle me in the safe room. David says, All right, sir. Then please listen to what I have to say. I said I would. He stares right at me with his tired face and haunted eyes and says, I want in. After a moment of surprise on my end, I say, Hold on, David, hold on. This is going to be rough, rugged, and mostly illegal. If you come along, he shakes his head. What? If I come along, my career's over? It's already finished. All that's left are the congressional hearings and the disciplinary proceedings. I'll be lucky to keep my pension, and right now I don't give a shit about that. I want to help you, Mr. President. David. He leans forward in the worn wicker chair. Mr. President, let me rephrase what I just said. I need to come with you. His eyes are still haunted, but there's a pleading in there as well. What are you looking for, David? Redemption? A harsh shake of the head. No, sir. Just like you. Justice. There's a determination in his eyes, and I'm sure he's looking for justice, but I see what he means when he says he needs this. We all do. All right, I say, clasping my tired hands together. I'm going to need a lot of burner cell phones and prepaid debit cards set up under false email addresses, and I'll probably need a few trusted operators to join me. I'll be doing a lot of digging, a lot of off-the-grid research. I've got some cash in the bedroom safe. If you want to help, spend a day or two traveling to different stores in the area. Make sure you're wearing a hat or something to hide your features. Get a Chrome laptop or something similar from Best Buy. The phones from different stores. You'll need to set up an encrypted email account to activate the phones and to purchase some prepaid debit cards. Then I stop. There's a slight smile on his face. I say, Sorry, David. I'm telling you your job, the ins and outs of tradecraft. You don't need to hear that from me. You know what I need and how best to do it. That's all right, Mr. President, he says, getting up from the chair. I'll be checking the perimeter here in a few minutes. If you have the cash when I come back, I can get to work. Thanks, David, I say. But I have to say, and with my apologies, sir, that I already knew what you were up to. That surprises me. How? Because when you've been working out in the shed over the past 2 weeks, I knew you had your weapons with you and had been practicing dry fire and getting reacclimated to holding an automatic rifle or pistol. Pretty clear if you stand close enough to the shed and listen. I should probably be upset, but instead I'm impressed. Good job again, David. Thanks. As he walks to the screen door, he does something very unprofessional and very unsecret service-like. A gentle grasp of my shoulder. No, sir, he says. I'm the one who should be thanking you. He goes back into the main house, and I wait for a while, peering up at the cloudy skies where it looks like the rain has finally stopped, at least reducing the misery index for those soaked agents out there on the two Boston Whalers. I rub my face and chin. Time to get shaved, showered, and dressed in clean clothes. It's time to get back to work.
Chapter 70. Lake Marie, New Hampshire. After checking the perimeter security and finding out that a two-agent CAT team has just arrested a photographer from a supermarket tabloid trying to sneak onto the property to take photos of the grieving former president, Agent David Stahl goes to the kitchen, looking to grab a glass of cold water before heading out. A few minutes earlier, he was in his small office in the barn, where he found a white business-sized envelope with 20 crisp $100 bills on his chair. But Chief of Staff Madeline Perry is blocking his way to the stainless steel refrigerator in the large kitchen, a hard and determined look on her face. She has on black slacks and a red pullover sweater with the sleeves rolled up, and she doesn't look happy. We need to talk, David. Okay, he says, not sure what the problem is and hoping it's nothing major. David has had years of experience dealing with White House staff,
And those folks have run the gamut from thinking Secret Service agents are servants at their beck and call, grim-jawed angels of death, or part of the background to be ignored. All in all, David prefers to be ignored. Being part of the background is what the job is all about. When it comes to Madeline, David has found her to be tough but reasonable. She understands the Secret Service's job at this former president's home, but isn't afraid to push back if she thinks some of the agents are too gung-ho in enforcing the rules. For the most part, he's liked working with her. But a few seconds later, that observation goes down in flames, like a World War II bomber being taken down by fighter aircraft. She says in a cold voice, "What in hell are you thinking? Helping Harbor plan a kill mission for Asim al-Ashid? That's nuts." "How the hell?" he thinks. And she says, "I know what you're thinking. I'm not proud of it, and I own it. But I was walking by the screen door to the porch when I heard you talking to Harbor. David, what the hell are you thinking?" David is thinking furiously. That's what he's thinking. He knew that down the road he'd have to do some serious spinning and falsification to make this happen for the president and himself, but he didn't expect the damn thing to be compromised before anything even started. He says, "It's not nuts." "It sure as hell sounds like it," she says. "I know he's grieving, I know he's looking for revenge, we all are, but this is lunacy. Let the professionals handle it, not a former president with a bum hip who's overwhelmed with grief and guilt." David says, "Professionals? The Barnes administration didn't cover themselves in glory now, did they? Especially with that bullshit story that the president really wanted to pay the ransom but was overruled by the FBI and others? You've seen the follow-up stories. Her spin was so much crap." "We don't know that for sure, do we?" she says. "It's just one side spinning against the other. Typical DC bullshit, I know, but please. You know this should be left to the professionals." "Well," he says, "the professionals have been looking for Asim al-Ashid for years, and they've come up empty time and time again. Why is this time going to be any different? And do you think Harbor will be able to do it? Really?" Stahl takes a breath, tries to ease things out and keep his cool. "Maddie, what's going on? You've worked with Harbor, his wife, and his daughter for years. Why this pushback?" She looks away, and David knows he's struck home. Something is behind this chief of staff's blustery attitude, more than just her wish to derail Harbor from doing what must be done. Perry is now looking back at him, eyes wide, moistened. "I believed in him, David, and it sucked when he was denied a second term, and I thought I could do well by him by following him in his post-presidency, especially when he said he'd be setting up a charitable foundation for vets." The tears start trickling. "Harbor doesn't know this, so please don't tell him. But one of my cousins served with honor in the Rangers. At the end of Harbor's term, he froze to death on the streets in Detroit, like other homeless veterans across the country. Harbor said that would never happen again, and that his foundation would take care of vets, all of their needs." "Now it all makes sense," Stahl thinks. "The foundation hasn't been set up yet, has it?" Perry shakes her head. "On paper, yes. But where it matters, in the accounts, there's hardly any money in there. We were planning on him writing his memoir, covering everything from growing up poor in Texas to serving in the teams, and then a career in politics, and then the shock of being president. That book would earn him and his charitable foundation millions, and then the aid would start flowing, so never again would there be a homeless vet on the streets." She takes a deep breath. "But he hasn't written a damn word. It's always tomorrow, tomorrow, or next week. While I'm trying to help Robert Barnett, his literary agent, negotiate a good publishing deal without even a damn outline. Now he wants to go out on a revenge mission. You know it's not going to work. It's going to end in humiliation." "That might be," Stahl says. "But it doesn't matter now, does it? He's going." "Yes, it does matter," Perry says, voice firm. "If it fails, and you know it will, the publishers will stop returning my phone calls, and those vets he wants to help will be ignored." "Maddie, you're making good points, but it's above my pay grade. He's doing it, and we can't stop him." "Please, David," she says, "let the agencies hunt down Asim al-Ashid. They have a lot more resources than Harbor could ever get on his own." Stahl starts to turn away from the president's chief of staff, thinking he'll have to wait a bit longer before getting his cold water. "But they don't have one thing, Maddie," he says. "What's that?" "A father who's going to get the job done, no matter what it takes."
Chapter 71. Lake Marie, New Hampshire. Alone in my office, which might make a good book title one of these days, the lights are dimmed, and I lean back in an old leather swivel chair that came with the place. The computer is off, and there's no view out my small window, which is fine. No distant lights over there on the lake, marking neighbors having fun and living life and laughing and talking amongst themselves. The bookshelves in my small office are packed with histories, autobiographies, and reference books on military matters, and similar books are piled up on the floor. Samantha often teased me that I have too many books, and I retorted by saying, "No, the problem is not enough bookshelves." What little bare plaster remains displays framed family photos, some faded color shots of me growing up in Texas with Lucille Keating, my mom, who died 10 years back from lung cancer. My dad was Gus Keating, who worked on a rig in the Gulf of Mexico, got drunk on smuggled Jack Daniels, and fell overboard and drowned when I was 5. There have been a number of books and studies concerning the SEALs, and one odd fact that has stood out is that most operators, like myself, either come from a broken home or were raised by single parents. I've resisted the urge over the years to put up what I call a see-how-great-I-am wall with plaques, trophies, and framed certificates. That's a sign of looking back, and I've always been one to look forward. On my desk, with the silent computer, are the photos that mean the most to me. Of young Mel growing up, of me standing proudly next to Samantha after she got her doctorate, and one taken here a couple of winters ago in the snowy front yard with the three of us standing and smiling amid the whiteness, ready for whatever was ahead for all of us during my post-presidency. I pick up a yellow legal pad from a pile that Maddie Perry got for me months back to help me write my autobiography. I get a pen and get to work. No time to worry about the past, I think. At my feet is a white and blue plastic Walmart bag, and I take out the first of about a dozen charged and active track phones purchased at various stores around the county. Using my personal iPhone as a directory, I make my first call overseas. It rings and rings, and then an irritated voice with a touch of a Brooklyn accent answers. "Who the hell is this?" demands Danny Cohen, retired head of Mossad. "And how did you get this number?" "Danny, please don't hang up," I say. "It's Matt Keating." Instantly, the tone of his voice changes, and he says, "Oh, Matt, so sorry to answer like that. My phone said unknown caller," and interrupting, I say, "I'm using a disposable phone over here. Is yours secure?" "It is," he says. "Matt, again, Dora and I send you our deepest sympathies for the loss of Mel. Heartbreaking." "I know," I say, the pen firmly in my grasp. "The card and letter you sent us both were very much welcomed. But Danny..." "Yes," he crisply says. "You're using a burner phone. This isn't the social call. What kind of help are you looking for?" Everything and anything on a CMLS sheet, his friends, associates, anything that will give me a good lead on his current whereabouts. "You've got it," he says. "How long are you going to have that disposable phone in your possession?" "A day," I reply, amazed at Danny's quick and affirmative answer. "I'll start with a fresh one tomorrow," he says. "Then feel free to call me anytime, no matter what, for updates. I'll get to work on this. I know your agencies are also looking for Asim, but we both know what happens when competing agencies are seeking the same information." I don't need the reminder. The disaster of 9/11 could have been easily avoided if the CIA, FBI, Customs, and others had put aside their turf wars, and if Congress had permitted cross-channel communications to allow these agencies to easily exchange data and intelligence. Things have improved since that dark Tuesday, but there is still a ways to go. I said, "Danny, this is incredibly generous. I was half expecting some pushback or a lot of questions." "I have no questions for you," he says, "because I know what you are planning, and it's not my place to argue with you or to try to discourage you. You know our history, Matt. We know the importance of family and the importance of settling accounts, no matter the time, no matter the cost. Again, Call it anytime. I'm honored to assist. Shalom lacha, my friend. He disconnects the call. I rub at my eyes and get back to work. The second call is nearly identical to the first, except the accent is a touch of Arab and British. Who is this? Is the sharp demand of Ahmad bin Nayef, former deputy director of Saudi Arabia's General Intelligence Directorate. Where are you calling from? From New Hampshire, Ahmad, I say. It's Matt Keating. As with Danny, the tone of the voice changes. Ah, Matt, so good to hear from you. And again, my deep condolences. How are you and Samantha doing? Samantha's back at work, trying to get by day by day, I say. Me, I'm doing my best. Ahmad, is this call secure? I'm on a disposable cell phone. Yes, yes, quite secure, he says. Or my nephew will be in great trouble otherwise. Matt, please, what can I do for you? Anything you learn concerning Asim al-Rashid's whereabouts, I say. It doesn't have to be 100%. It can be anything that can be developed into a lead, whatever you have that can be shared. A moment or two passes. Are you sure, my friend? Absolutely. This is a dangerous task you are taking on. I say, are you telling me no? Oh, Matt, not at all, not at all, he says. It's just, and please take this with my deep and true affection, and with the greatest respect, but this is a job for a younger man, or younger men, more recent in their skills, and not, alas, with a healed, fractured hip. This needs to be done. Yes, of course, Ahmad says. But let me offer you an alternative. If I am incredibly fortunate and somehow manage to get actionable information on Asim, I will personally do something with it. I could pass on the information to the responsible officials here in the kingdom, but it may stay there and be analyzed and reanalyzed and not to be shared with your agencies. Some here in Riyadh, I am sorry to say, admire Asim al-Rashid. Hard to hear, but I know Ahmad is right. He says, as for me, though, if I know where he is, through luck and the kindness of Allah, I can send a squad of men, very hard, very tough, trained by your SEALs and the British SAS, and they will do this job for you. God, what a tempting offer, but one I cannot accept, not if I hope to live with myself in the years ahead. Ahmad, I am touched and honored more than I could tell you, I say. But I have to do this myself, for my family. He speaks briskly. I entirely understand. You know how to contact me, and I promise I won't bark at you the next time I see an unknown caller on my phone screen. But at any time, Matt, my offer remains. We can do this for you. Thank you again, Ahmad, I say, but I have to see this through on my own. Very well, he says. What they on, Matt? After my second call ends and before I resume my work, I think of the oddity that just happened. Years ago, Danny's grandfather and Ahmad's grandfather no doubt hated each other's country and people, and each in their own way would have been greatly pleased to see the other destroyed. Now, not only do their grandchildren secretly work together in that turbulent region to bring some form of peace and stability, but both are now working to help a former American president in his own personal mission. Maybe there's still some hope out there. Somewhere. I go back to my phones and return to the task at hand.